could say all the Ptolemaic pharaohs were of Macedonian descent, because they all descended from Ptolemy the First. Not to be confused with Ptolemy the geographer, who favored the astronomer, somebody completely different. But Ptolemy the First, as I mentioned the other day, was this man, Alexander. Alexander's childhood friend. And as Alexander was tutored by Aristotle, it's very likely that Ptolemy was too. And then Ptolemy became one of Alexander's generals. And you know, once Alexander crossed into Asia, he never went back to Greece, or never went back to Macedonia again. And once he went to Egypt and founded Alexandria, he never returned to Egypt. He headed off east into Asia, to Afghanistan, all the way to India. I think it's not in popular awareness that there was an Indo-Greek civilization on the banks of the Indus River for 300 years. And if you look at the art from that period, the Gandhara period, the most exquisite bodhisattvas, where you see the meeting of Buddhism, because Afghanistan was Buddhist at the time, where you see the melding of Greek art and Buddhist art, that's absolutely exquisite. Of course, mostly in Alexandria, it's the melding of Greek and Egyptian cultures, civilizations, spiritualities, and it's that that gives birth to this phenomenal, phenomenal voice. And it really does amaze me that, I don't know who, Harvard, Oxford, somebody, would, have beaten us to the punch and actually gone to Alexandria and done some big international conference on ancient Alexandria. But it just doesn't seem to have happened. I mean, when I had the gall to show up in October at the Bibliotheca Alexandrina and propose to them that we do a conference together on the world of ancient Alexandria, they were thrilled. They just said, well, could you provide the faculty? That's all. They didn't really have a lot of the faculty. And I said, well, no problem. We can definitely do that. We know the people. And so lo and behold, this is going to be, I don't know when, if ever, sometime it must have happened. I don't know when that there was a conference last on this realm. Because, the whole world of this world, of Lawrence Durrell and Justine, and Balthazar, and Clea, and Mount Olive, the Alexandria Quartet that brought alive Alexandria. When I was a boy, this was the big Lady Chatterley's Lover, and the Alexandria Quartet. Every teenage boy was trying to get his hands on that. And but I actually didn't read it until recently. I guess I'm glad I waited. Because I would have missed all the references to Gnosticism and Hermeticism, I wouldn't have understood them by seeing them. But even that world that Lawrence Durrell portrays, and this is set between the wars, between the two world wars, even that is gone. Cosmopolitan Alexandria, that Alexandria as cosmopolis that it was, as the world city, for all those centuries, from 300 BC to 400 AD, roughly speaking. And then it came back in the 19th century when the Ottoman Pasha Muhammad Ali, decided to build a European city that could trade with Europe. It all came back, and then for another wonderful 150 years, from the beginning of the 19th century to 1956, it was once again a tremendous cosmopolis. And this is what Durrell evokes, this is what E.M. Forster so impressed by. This is what Constantin Kavafi, who's one of whose poems I'm going to read a little later, the great Greek poet of Alexandria, the greatest Greek, considered Greek national poet of the 20th century, but he was from Alexandria. Because up until 1956, there was a population of 300,000 Greeks in Alexandria. Hard to believe. 300,000 Greeks. 70,000 Jews, 12,000 Brits, 10,000 French, 8,000 Italians, and countless numbers of Lebanese, Syrians, Armenians, on and on. It was just an unbelievably creative gathering of cultures, and that's what Lawrence Durrell celebrates. But it all came to an end in 1956 with the Suez Canal crisis, which I remember well, even though I was only 7 years old at the time. But of course, that was an attempt by the British and the French with Israeli support to grab the Suez Canal after Nasser, the Arab nationalist, had nationalized the canal. And it didn't work. Eisenhower actually opposed it. And Nasser announced from one of the main squares in Alexandria that he was expelling all foreigners from Egypt in retaliation. And that was the end of this extraordinary period. But nevertheless, it'll come back. There's something in the water, in the atmosphere, in the environment, in the destiny of Alexandria to take on this quality. So I think I'll start by just... I was mentioning to you that I barely finished writing the brochure for the next catalogue. We were seeing if we could have it done for this weekend, but I think it's better to give you the finished version rather than something that's 80% done with all the typos and without any design around it. So you'll be getting it in the near future. But I thought I was reading it last night and thinking, how can I do better than just read some of the blurbs to take us into this. So here's one. It's called All Roads Lead to Alexandria. No better emblem of ancient Alexandria could there be than the Pharos Lighthouse. In one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Remember, they had the Artemis of Ephesus, they had the Pharos Lighthouse of Alexandria. It's an extraordinary thing. Do any of you know Alexandria, Virginia? You know, I've been going to Alexandria, Virginia for 20-odd years, and it was only when I got into ancient Alexandria that the penny dropped and I grasped that whole huge Washington monument in Alexandria is modeled upon the lighthouse of Alexandria. Duh, I don't know why, but it never crossed my mind before. I thought it was something Masonic. So there we have. We actually have a replica of the Pharos Lighthouse right in Alexandria, Virginia, across the river from D.C. Anyway, no better emblem of ancient Alexandria could there be than the lighthouse on Pharos Island. An ambience unique in history made Alexandria the city that questioned everything. And seekers from far and wide were drawn by its bright beacon to probe the nature of soul, body, and world as never before. They blaze spiritual and scientific trails that have defined the Western quest ever since. Old Alexandria lives on in the rising spirit of the new, in the evocative physical remnants of the past, and as an image of compelling possibilities. For the pursuer of deepest truth, all roads led and lead to Alexandria. That's Leonard George, who's a wonderful writer. Leonard can nail it, you know, he writes great blurbs. And Leonard is somebody who's worked closely with me on doing the Alexandria Conference. And, he's a great Canadian scholar of the esoteric and a psychologist too. And so it was Leonard going to Alexandria 2 or 3 years ago after our quest in Greece and Turkey that encouraged me to do this, because I'd been in Alexandria 20 years ago and I was not sure, but it's really the building of the Bibliotheca Alexandrina, the new Library of Alexandria, that makes it possible. We've got, because of course, to do something like that in a wild, big, intense Egyptian city of 5.5 million people, you've got to have somebody on the ground. So we have the Alexandria Mediterranean Research Center at the Bibliotheca Alexandria, so the whole conference will actually take place. Let me read you a little bit more from David Feidler, who who many of you will know because he edited the magazine, or it became an annual journal, really, Alexandria, for many years. And so I thought, how could we possibly do a conference on Alexandria without inviting David? So David will be there. So Alexandria the Cosmopolis. The Greek philosophers had spoken of the cosmopolis, the world city in which all individuals are related to one another, regardless of country, race, or religion. But with the coming of the Hellenistic Age, the idea of global civilization became a tangible reality. And Alexandria, its most significant expression, a meeting point between East and West, philosophies and religions, and disparate cultures. And then he goes on to say, once again, we find ourselves in a global community, talking about today. But what makes for a genuine world community? And how is the ancient idea relevant for our own times? In a time of conflict, is there a higher unity that can foster harmony between different religions? So I think in engaging with Alexandria, it's not just an antiquarian exercise. You do see a cosmopolis there. And of course, there's lots of parallels to New York today, but we're living in a time again of a universal cultural and spiritual impulse, where we're seeing the connections between all cultures, all spiritual paths. Of course, this is what the Open Center is dedicated to. So, and that be, I think I'll read you another little blurb. But divine women, Cleopatra and Hypatia. Cleopatra VII was the last Ptolemaic ruler and the one most attuned to Egypt's spiritual roots. She felt a deep link to the goddess Isis and doubtless took strength from this as she nearly managed to revive Egypt as a superpower of antiquity. 4 centuries later, another Alexandrian, Hypatia, drew seekers, both pagan and Christian, from throughout the Roman Empire to learn the mysteries of the sacred eye that lies buried in the soul. Both women fell victim to the power struggles of the times, but their legacies transcend their turbulent era and speak to ours. And then one last one from the inimitable Chris Bamford. Alexandria, crossroads of Judaism, Hellenism, Gnosticism, and Christianity. Alexandria, around the time of Christ, opened a new age of infinite possibilities, of paths taken and not taken. During this period, Jewish philosophers like Philo, so-called Gnostics like Basilides and Valentinus, Neoplatonists like Plotinus, and Christian theologians like Clement and Origen, rubbed shoulders with Egyptian priests, gymnosophists from India, and alchemical adepts. Out of this mix, rabbinic Judaism, Christianity, and Hermeticism would arise. This talk aims to evoke the amazing richness, newness, and fruitfulness of what was given birth, and it'll consider those spiritual impulses which still perhaps await germination. So there we go, just a little teaser, but as you can see, this is going to be deep. It's going to be deep and intense. Because I have the highest respect for those of you who know them in my wonderful team of Carrie and Andrea. But it's going to be these two feisty, small American women taking on all the chaos and mayhem of Egypt. And, but if anybody can pull it off, they can. But I think when we get to Egypt, we're just going to have to chill out. Because we're just going to have to accept that things flowing in a smooth, linear, seamless way is not the nature of the Egyptian experience. There's something inherently wild and crazy about the place. And you love it, you know, after a while. The thing is, it takes you 3 or 4 days to really get into the soul of Egypt. But once you get there, it's like you really start to enjoy it. You know, everything. And there's nothing corporate, there's nothing antiseptic. Everything has soul and wildness and the unexpected. It's profoundly other. But the people are very nice. I found the people were very nice in Alexandria. Didn't get, not many people speak English, but I got nothing but good vibes from everybody, even though walking to Cornish late at night, I'd probably be the only Westerner, but it was very pleasant. All right, well, let's go on and, you know, let's talk a little bit about Alexandria, how it came to be. So, it all starts with that man here, Alexander the Great. And what a guy! Conquers the world by the time he's in his early 30s. Nobody's ever done that before or since. And how about did he do it? An incredible guy. You know, his father, Philip II of Macedonia, was an initiate of Samothrace, another mystical island where we did the quest, the site of one of the great mysteries of the ancient world. His parents are said to have met on Samothrace. His mother was particularly devoted to the mysteries and was intent on educating him in all of that. His father, you know, at the appropriate age, designates his tutor. And of course, as we've said many times, his tutor is Aristotle. I mean, how can you imagine having a more amazing tutor than Aristotle? I mean, what does that mean? But obviously, he's an incredibly gifted young guy. His father unifies or invades Greece and unifies it under a Macedonian banner. And then they set off to the east. You know, they take on the Persian Empire, which is huge. Eliminates that, heads on down into Egypt. He sees the site of Alexandria and just has the intuition, let us build a city here. But it wasn't just an attempt to implement a lot of Aristotle's insights and principles. So there was a lot of Aristotelian wisdom that went into the founding of Alexandria. Just the creation, the sheer practicality of it. The way the island of Pharos, where the lighthouse was connected by a bridge or a causeway to the mainland, thereby creating two amazing ports, the Eastern Harbor, the Western Harbor. The main Canopic Highway was situated so that the prevailing breezes blew down there and kept the city fresh. And as we'll see when I show you a map, it's situated perfectly to be the cosmopolis. Because as we know, to the east, Alexander's empire extended as far as India, so we're getting the culture and wisdom of India, the Indian gymnosophists that Chris Bamford mentioned. So they're coming from the east. It's at the mouth, it's near where the Nile pours into the Mediterranean, so we're getting the wisdom, the culture, the peoples of Africa, of sub-Saharan Africa, making their way down the Nile, all the way there. We're getting, of course, the whole culture of the Middle East, ancient Persia, Afghanistan, and so on, a little further east, Assyria, and all of that, all the way up into the Greek colonies in the Black Sea, so stretching all the way up to Crimea and what is now the Ukraine and Russia. And then, of course, the whole Mediterranean basin itself, with all those extraordinary cultures. So as they say, there were really three great cities in antiquity. We all know Rome and Athens, but Alexandria was the one that built its empire upon military prowess after Alexander's death, but upon the richness of its culture, its brilliance, its science, its learning. And as Aristotle said, all men by nature desire to know. And so, you know, the very first library is said to have been Aristotle's collection of books, his own personal library. Plato's nickname for Alexander for Aristotle was the Reader. That's a good name to have for the guy who creates the first library. And as we'll see, actually, I think I'll read you David Feidler's, one of David Feidler's other blurbs. Well, he talks about the origins of the library. He calls it the golden thread of the Muses, how the museum and library came to Alexandria. The museum and library at Alexandria were the first attempts to acquire and preserve all human knowledge and advance the development of knowledge in an institutional setting. It's a pretty amazing thing. The first attempt to acquire and preserve all human knowledge and advance it in an institutional setting. This made Alexandria the world's first university town, you might say. But little has ever been written about how the museum and library were actually founded. The surprising fact is that these institutions were founded by a member of Aristotle's school to advance the kind of systematic research that had begun earlier in Athens. And so we will explore the earlier Greek academies of the Muses, including Plato's Academy, and how they led to the formation of the museum and the library. So let's look at how Alexandria came to be. There he is. There's the amazing Alexandria. And some of us will remember being in Alexandropolis. Actually, it was the port on the mainland that we departed from to get to Samothrake. And, you know, when I first went there, there was a wonderful plaque from Alexandria in the airport. And it was speaking about, it was after all the battles were over, the empire had been created. It was Alexander's vision of how everybody should be treated. And it was, any Greek who behaves like a barbarian will not be accorded his appropriate rights. But any non-Greek who lives with the dignity and values of a Greek will be given all the full recognition of rights and so on. I can't quote it to you verbatim, I just saw it once, but it was an incredibly contemporary statement of a multicultural acceptance of all religions, all ethnicities, as all having equal merit and all coming together to form one unity. Really, somebody could have uttered it 10 years ago, or today even, and it would still have been relevant. So Alexander was just amazingly far in. Of course, he had a shadow side as well, but who doesn't? But yes. And there's our man. There's Aristotle. And he looks serious, doesn't he? He looks a pretty smart guy. You wouldn't want to get into an argument with him.
He doesn't look exactly as he usually
says. Yeah, well, he looks better than Socrates. And of course, never in human history have we had a sequence like we have there, where you've got Socrates, and then about 40 years later, 30 or 40 years later, along comes Socrates' student Plato, and then 30 or 40 years later, along comes Plato's student Aristotle. Boom, boom, boom. Never in history have we had a sequence. I mean, maybe somewhere in Asia there was, but in Western history at least, I believe there's no known sequence of brilliant philosophers and minds like that. And of course, Alexander didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of that tremendous foundation of Greek wisdom, of Greek philosophy, and Greek science that these guys established. So actually, Alec, it's interesting, just to give you a little bit more to bring, where is it? Well, he was the, the reader, as I was saying, he was called by Plato. He was appointed by Philip of Macedon, you know, Alexander's father, overseer of all the royal forests, lakes, rivers, and cattle ranges. So he wasn't just some ivory tower academic. There wasn't even an academy at that point. He was actually overseeing all the royal forests, lakes, rivers, and cattle ranges. And studying it all, looking to systematize it, looking to understand all the different plants, animals, looking to bring it all together in a huge body of knowledge while having a profound worldview. So there he is, Aristotle. And there's obviously a 19th century or so, I don't know when that was painted, but a depiction, an artist's impression of what Alexander would have been like, leading his extraordinary armies. And that gives you a sense of the extent of Alexander's empire. We can barely even see, we don't even have Macedonia on this map, you know, it's right up there in the top left-hand corner. You see Greece there, so Macedonia is at the north of Greece, where it enters the Balkans. So you've got Alexander's empire, you can't even see Macedonia. So, you know, so he comes over, he
takes on the Persians in Asia Minor. He sweeps down through what is now Lebanon and Israel and Palestine, and then on to Alexandria. He takes this legendary journey to the oasis of Siwa, where he almost dies, S-I-W-A, because he wanted to go to the oracle of Siwa to see, was he in fact divine? And his interpretation of the oracle was that he was, in fact, divine. Of course, that gave him the tremendous courage to go on and do all of that. So he left Egypt, and then, you know, then he was on to, well, what would now be Iraq and Iran, Afghanistan, you know, and then all the way into what would now be Pakistan and India. It's just a stunning achievement. And but he dies. He dies at the age of 33 in Babylon. Babylon, in what is now Iraq, see between the Tigris and the Euphrates. So he dies there of some kind of fever. Nobody knows. Some people think it was poison. People think it never been determined what exactly happened. And so then, of course, and then he had no plans, he had no legacy, he didn't leave any clear will or instructions on how things would proceed. So then there was a struggle over what would happen. And it broke up. The empire broke up into the different sections. You can see the Seleucid dynasty over there, and then the kingdom of Ptolemy over here. So, but one crucial thing was what would happen to Alexander's body. So the body was sent to head back towards Macedonia, but Ptolemy was a very shrewd individual, and Ptolemy captured Alexander's body. He knew wherever the body was, that's where the attention would be, and he took it to Alexandria. And then that's where it became the center of the whole city, the Soma, it was called, the body. It, you know, it was right at the center of the Canopic Way and another main road that came on down. So there you can see Alexandria more. You can see the sense of it. Here's the Nile. This is Thebes or Luxor, which will be one of our post-conference possibilities. If no people have never done ancient Egypt, the Temple of Manishwala, the Lubits called it, the Temple of Karnak, across the other west side on the west bank of the Valley of the Kings, all kinds of wonderful and exquisite temples, etc. Hermopolis, see that Hermopolis up there? That's where the Hermetic tradition originates, literally, the beginning. The city devoted to the god Hermes, who of course is a Greek adaptation of Thoth. Thoth, the Ibis-headed god. And what's one of the characteristic features of the Isis, of the Ibis? The Ibis is often to be seen on the shores of the Nile, wading on the banks of the Nile, in that liminal in-between world between the sand on the shore and the river itself. So the ibis is the classic symbol of liminality. And so this is Hermes communicating between the worlds there. So that's Hermopolis. And in fact, one of the speakers at the conference, a lovely Egyptian woman called Mervat Nasser, who's actually been a psychiatrist at London University for years when she's not doing things in Egypt. But she is actually starting something called the New Hermopolis. She's trying to get it going again to create actually a cultural center, a kind of open center in Hermopolis. If you check it out, newhermopolis.org. You can see she has just started a website. She's trying to get some support for it by people contributing to the planting of trees. But anyway, there's Hermopolis. You see up in Memphis, the old capital there? Memphis up near there as the estuary begins to open up. And then where we'll be going the very first afternoon, the pyramids of Saqqara. We're going to go there the first day in Cairo rather than to the Giza pyramids because it's such a tourist scene in the Giza pyramids. So we'll go to the pyramids of Saqqara, which are the biggest archaeological site in the whole of Egypt. And they were the necropolis for Memphis, the old capital city of ancient Greece, of ancient Egypt. So you can see everything's coming down here from sub-Saharan Africa, things can come from India, up there through the Gulf, up there to Sinai. To the east, we see Gaza there, so you've got the whole Middle Eastern world out there, and then the whole world of Europe is and the Mediterranean. And there were even Gauls in Alexandria, people from what is now France. So you can see why it would be a cosmopolis. And there's the, nobody knows, of course, we don't have, there were, must have been sketches and drawings of the original library, but everything was lost. Because after the death of Hypatia, you know, things were really in decline for a long time, they've been in decline even at that point. And then, of course, when Islam comes, there's not a huge amount of interest in all of this, even though it does make its way into Islam. And so that when Napoleon arrived at the end of the 18th century in Alexandria, it was just a fishing village with a couple of thousand people, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people living there, and no trace or memory of ancient Alexandria. But of course, Napoleon did actually bring all these artists and Egyptologists with us. He was an unusual character, Napoleon, to say the least. So. Anyway, this is just an artist's impression of what the ancient library of Alexandria must have looked like, but of course it's fulfilling Aristotle's mission to gather all knowledge at that time. And really for 100 years, from 300 BC to 200 BC, you've got a succession of three Ptolemies, Ptolemy the First, the Second, and the Third. They were all deep people, they were all scholarly people, they were all deeply dedicated to preserving the mission of the library and the museum. Now the museum, of course, is the center of the house of the muses. And it really, this becomes what it is, in effect, the world's first university, and that there are laboratories there are lecture halls, and there are the manuscripts. Every ship that pulls into Alexandria, if it's carrying a manuscript, it's necessary to they have to give over that manuscript, and then the scholars at the library will copy it and then return it. So eventually Alexandria winds up with a library of 750,000 volumes or scrolls. It's hard to imagine. Of course, nobody knows the exact number, but it is huge. Now think about this. It's estimated that today we have 1% of the literature of antiquity. 1%. So even though we have, we've got Homer and Plato and Aristotle and all those people and Euclid and so on, it's 1%. 99% of it is lost. It's it really is just, when you really tune into that, it gives us quite a task in our forthcoming Alexandrian conference to bring alive that 99% in 5 days. Well, we'll give it a try. that's another artist's impression. I was like that one because I think it conveys something of what it must actually have looked like.
May I ask you a question?
Yes.
The other libraries at Ephesus and Pergamon,
yeah.
Were the works there incorporated into the Library of Alexandria?
Yeah, well, eventually the Library of Pergamon was, because part of the Library of Alexandria was destroyed when Julius Caesar was bombarding Alexandria. He set fire. It's unclear whether it was the library itself or whether it was just some kind of warehouse. Anyway, it was damaged. And so, if I remember correctly, when Mark Antony came along, not that much later, he gave Cleopatra the whole library of Pergamon as a replacement to make up for what Julius Caesar had done. So it was transported, because Pergamon was they had the papyrus there, or they had a certain kind of parchment that was really unique. Anyway, the whole library was transported from the Ionian coast of Asia Minor to there. And interestingly enough, one of Cleopatra's daughters, who was allowed to live, married a king of North Africa, King Jubal, I think it was, And she wound up creating a small replica of the Library of Alexandria somewhere in the borders of what is now Morocco and Algeria. Next time I go to Morocco, I want to go there and check it out. Maybe we'll wind up doing an exodus. I love Morocco, you know, because we went there. That's where we met the Sufis after Andalusia. But it would be fascinating to, if there's anything left of it, to track down that that Library of Alexandria, because you know she was her mother's daughter. She really wanted to continue that. It's a whole long story about Alexander. Because there you've got the Pharos Lighthouse, which could be seen for 40 miles out at sea. So you've got this, Alexandria becomes this tremendous center for trade, because you've got your ships coming in from all over the Mediterranean. You've got, there's this Lake Mariotis, which is right behind Alexandria. The northern part of Alexandria goes onto the Mediterranean, and the southern part looks onto Lake Mariotis, so all the ships would come from down the Nile and be unloaded from the lake. So this could be seen from 40 miles around, with the great statue of Neptune right up on top, and the mirror that shone a light out far into the sea. So as I say, one of the great wonders of the ancient world. And here we have Serapis. So we talk about, you know, the meeting of Egyptian and Greek cultures. So that is a syncretic deity there, Serapis. And he's a mix of Osiris, Cyrus, and Apis, who was a bull-like deity, who are fertility from the region of the Nile Delta. So it was originally Osiris Apis, but it wound up being contracted into Serapis. So you can see the grain, that's the grain, because Egypt became the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. It was incredibly fertile in terms of the grain there. And you can see he's the mix of the Greek facial features. And we will actually... we'll go to the site of where the Serapeum was, which is very close to here. This is Alexandria. We'll be going to this. These are the catacombs. It's probably the most gripping archaeological site in Alexandria. But you can see the different. There's both Greek and Egyptian symbolism there. You know, I always love that, you know, the Hall of the 49 Assessors, the classic image. When we go to the Egyptian Museum, the situation that the soul faces after death, where you see it many, many times in illustrations there, where the soul is now encountering Osiris, the Lord of the Underworld. And the first experience the soul must undergo is that the heart must be weighed on the scales against the feather of truth. And so we better hope that old heart, well, that must be nerve-wracking when you see if the scales are going, oh no! So let's hope that all those scales balance pretty nicely. And because then, you know, you've got Ibis, Thoth,